Appreciate you. All right, this evening we are continuing our study looking at the book of Joshua, specifically looking at it through the lens of understanding leadership. I think the book of Joshua is very interesting in and of itself because of all the narratives that we read in there and things that are going on with Israel and Joshua specifically. And what we've done over the past few weeks is piece together, starting with the idea of how did we get here? All right, when you transition from the book of Deuteronomy over into Joshua, what are some things that are going on to lead us to this point? And so we examined that. We looked at Joshua as an individual, how he came to be a leader, and what did Moses do along with God to train him and bring him up to where he is. And then we started looking at stories as we're going through the book of Joshua and identifying characteristics that a leader needs to have and how we need to implement those. We've talked about courage, we've talked about unity, and tonight we're going to be talking about humility. So as we go through the book of Joshua, kind of where we are so far, in Joshua chapter 1, God has this conversation with Joshua telling him, you need to be strong and courageous because the task that you are given is going to be very difficult, but if you keep your eyes on me, you're going to be okay. You'll be successful because God says, if you will make sure that your feet are right where they're supposed to be, I'm going to guide you. I'm going to be along the way. And the rest of the book of Joshua is going to show us how that actually happens. We then leave from that passage and we find a scenario with a few of the tribes of Israel who had an allotment of land onto the on the east side of the Jordan River, which is where they are camped at right now. And they essentially become the vanguard because their families are going to remain on the east side of the Jordan, and Reuben and Manasseh and Ephraim are going to go across and they're going to be the vanguard. They're going to go first because they have a little bit more at stake, don't they? They've got their family that already has a place, and they said, okay, we're going to go fight so we can come back home to where they are. We're going to skip over just momentarily. We're going to connect it a little bit later on. We're going to skip over parts of Joshua chapter 2 with Rahab and the spies. The reason why we're going to do that is when we examine the book of, when we examine Jericho, we're going to pull that in together and we're going to look at the topic of being resolved as a leader. So as we're going through our study tonight, as we look at the topic of humility, we're going to jump past chapter 2. Don't worry, we're coming back. It's very important and there's points that we're going to get from it. But the reason why we are jumping to this one, though, is that we're going to see Israel cross over the Jordan River into the Promised Land, a place that they have been waiting for, that was given to Abraham, and have been waiting hundreds of years to be able to access, and that's what we are going to look at tonight. So let's start, though, considering this idea of humility. I don't know what comes to your mind when you think about humility. It might be a person, all right? So you see the word humble. Is there a particular person, is there a face that you associate with that? Maybe it's a relative. Maybe it's somebody that was a teacher or a coach or a mentor, somebody you look up to, and you think they are humble. Now, you may not have necessarily worked out why you think that is the case, but you just think humility, and then they come to mind. Maybe it's something about their demeanor, their disposition, how they carry themselves, how they speak, how maybe they don't speak in certain situations. Maybe it's a job that they had and how they worked along with it. So maybe you think about a person. Maybe you think about a particular attitude. Someone who is humble is fill in the blank. Maybe it's that particular character quality that you don't have someone in mind, although there's a lot of people you could maybe name that, you know, yeah, they showed this and I've seen them display this in this situation or that, but maybe it's a particular attitude. Maybe it is a position. When you think about someone who is humble, maybe it's something that they do. It's not any one particular person. It's not any one particular attitude they may have, but a way that they carry themselves in a certain position. Maybe it's something you... I think of humility when it comes to somebody in the church. Maybe it's in a job. Maybe it's in a, I don't know, any different ways that would come to mind of a position, somebody that gives up everything and they're going to take a humble, lowly state in life. Or maybe you might have in your mind the opposite of humility. When you think of humility, you think of someone who is arrogant. Sometimes we do that, don't we? We look at certain character traits and we think of the exact opposite and we have somebody in mind. We have their attitude in mind. We have their position in mind. And we've got them nailed like they are the exact opposite. I don't know what humility is. I just know it's not them. So maybe in our minds, when we think about this term, something along those lines will come up. If you're going to take a definition of humility, of course, there's a lot of different ones out there. And one that I found that I thought was good as we're going to apply this Humility is the ability to consider others' opinions, act with self-awareness, and lead from a spirit of generosity instead of narcissism. Now, this is more the application. If you think about someone who is a leader that is to be humble, it's going to look like this. Okay, someone who is able to listen to other people's opinions and not just shut it down as soon as somebody opens up their mouth or even thinks about opening their mouth. Someone who has self-awareness. They know where they stand and they know how they ought to act and what they should or should not do. And they act with generosity. You know, it comes from who they are. They care and they want to give, and it's not about them. As you think about humility, I want us to consider how Joshua had to deal with this. Now, the way that we're going to come about it is we're going to jump into Joshua chapters 3 and 4. I'm going to show you a verse in just a second where we're going to start putting in this idea of humility. And then we'll back up, get some context, work through it, and then draw some application from there. But in general, when you think about humility, it's a state of being. It's usually something to do with lowliness in rank or maybe in economic means. Humility is the opposite of importance or wealth. It can also refer to a virtue that involves a modest self-perception. It's the opposite of pride and arrogance. With that in mind, go to Joshua chapter 4. We're going to go to the tail end of the story that we're going to examine tonight, but I want to highlight this verse, and like I said, we'll backtrack from here. Joshua chapter 4, verse 14. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe of him, just as they stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life. Do you think Joshua needs humility with a description like this? I mean, here it is in God's word, a description really coming from God that Joshua is exalted. Now, of course, he's not the one that's doing it, right? He is not exalting himself. It's God who is doing the exalting. And there's actually a standard that comes before him, which is Moses. Look at Moses. Look at what he did. He was the meekest of them all, as it's described as well, right? But Joshua had to have humility with a description like this. Especially if he's writing it too, right? We got to consider that as well. But when you see Moses and all the things that God did with him, and you see Joshua, Joshua was right there with Moses in many of these situations that we examined in some of our earlier classes. But he still didn't have the same type of out front position until we get to this point in our study, right? He was there with Moses all along the way. Maybe he stood at the tent of meeting. Maybe he was on Mount Sinai when Moses was up there getting the commandments and he was guarding it. You know, he's been around the whole time as we saw some of these key verses, but now he is out front and he is leading the people. And things that we're going to see in this very first situation, there's many more that's going to happen in the book of Joshua, but in this first situation, we're going to see God working with him. And for God to work with somebody, they're going to need to show humility. We refer to this as being in subjection to God, submitting to him. That takes humility, doesn't it? So let's see what is involved in this story. So they are coming from the plains of Moab, and this is the picture that we've used, and they're going to be coming across the Jordan River, as you can see there, and coming over into the Promised Land. And so we're looking at it from the Promised Land out toward the plains of Moab and Mount Nebo, which is where Moses, that was where he got to look at the Promised Land, but did not get to enter into it. So that's where they're going to be coming from. They are camped at this side of the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan, and going to be working this way. So let's look at these verses, all right? We're going to read a little bit from Joshua 3 and make some observations as we go along. Joshua 3, starting in verse 1. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim, and they came to Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and they lodged before they passed over. One of the things that I notice here with Joshua, and it's a reoccurring phrase with God's people. If you ever see they rose early in the morning, it's actually telling us a frame of time, okay? So before the sun comes up, But it's also an idiom that somebody who rides early in the morning, they are resolute in their mind of what they're going to do. Makes me think about Mark's devotional that he gave here a couple of weeks ago about burning daylight, right? It's like, we don't want to burn daylight. We've got things that we need to do. So Joshua had his mind set on, all right, it's time for us to go over into the Jordan and across it into the promised land. So he gathers all the people, and they come to it, and they lodge there before they passed over. Verse 2, at the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, your God, being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Don't come near it, in order that you may know the way you should go, for you have not passed this way before. All right, so once again, get this wrapped into our minds. The promised land is just right over this Jordan. They've been camped here for a while. And the Jordan River, although it is, you know, it's not like the Red Sea that they're going to have to cross over, but it's still an impediment for hundreds of thousands of people going to have to cross over. At this point, as one of the verses is going to spell out in just a moment, this is the time of the year where the Jordan River would actually flood the banks. So it is expanded even further than just a simple channel, you know, going between two banks. It's overflowed it. And so it is a big, you know, a body of water to have to cross, especially when you've got supplies, you've got children, you've got families, you've got old, you got sick, all these things are involved. So that's been waiting there, and they've been waiting for 3 days. Now, this is not the same crowd that came to the Red Sea, but it is reminiscent of when the Israelites were escaping from Egypt, when they fled from there and they came across the Red Sea. When Moses was there at the brink of it, God caused a strong wind to blow, and it blew all night from the east, and it parted the Red Sea. Imagine sitting here for 3 days, though. What's going to happen? Now, they've already been prepared. Follow the ark. It's going to go before you, and it's going to lead the way because God is leading them, telling them where to go, and it's going to a place that you don't know the way. Speaking to the Israelites as a whole, but Joshua as well. Although Joshua has been into the promised land, remember he was one of the spies that went in originally, they have not gone this way before. Now, as we look at humility, as we're going to be studying through these passages, it takes a lot of humility to admit, as a leader, I don't know what's going to happen when you get there. Now, I don't know all the details. Joshua didn't have it all worked out. He just knew this is what God said, and they're going to wait to see what goes on. But they're going somewhere that none of them know the way, which means somebody does that they're going to have to depend on. It's not just Joshua that's got to learn humility, but it's going to be the people as well. Let's continue reading in verse 5. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. I love this this speech that he gives, although it's just one line. It's a pep talk. God's going to do wonders in front of you. God's going to do wonders for you. Now, this group of Israelites, like I said, they are not the ones that came up out of Egypt. They might have been younger, you know, we know the 40 years in the wilderness, all those things. They saw things happen in the wilderness. They've actually seen God lead them against some mighty kings and some peoples. But when they hear that term, wonders that God is able to do, they've heard all the stories. They know about the Red Sea. They know about the plagues. They know about all of it. And they get to participate in it as well. They're going to be able to see things. And once again, I think this is a reminder, it's God who is leading, not them. When God is going to come do wonders, you're not the one that's going to do wondrous things. It's God's hand. And that's the description. Anytime that God does a miracle, or a lot of times that God has performed a miracle, it's talked about when he reaches out his strong arm. It's God that's doing it, although he will use people along the way. Let's continue reading. Make a few more observations in our passage here. So Joshua said to the priest, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that you that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. Now, do you connect what we're reading here? Like I said, we jumped into the story, right? Chapter 4, verse 14. But this is telling Joshua, this is what's going to happen. I will begin to exalt you. The starting point. It's not Joshua who's doing the exalting. It's God. And that's always going to be the case. There's passages all throughout the Bible where we are to be humble before God. We are to submit to God. We are to bow before Him. And at the proper time, He will exalt us. That's what 1 Peter chapter 5 talks about. We submit ourselves to Him, and He's the one that will lift us. He is the lifter of our head. We'll read a few more verses in this section here. Verse 8, as for you, command the priest who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that He will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. So he's telling them, all right, priest, you're going to come to the brink of the Jordan, and when your toes touch it, the waters will be backed up, and the people are going to walk over on dry ground. And when you go into the land, you shall know that the living God is among you. Verse 11, behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth. You catch the description of God. Who's in control? It's God. Who's the one that's doing all the work? God. Who's doing the heavy lifting? God. Yes, they're carrying the Ark of the Covenant, and that's this representation of where God meets His people, but it's going in front of them, and they're going to be stepping into the Jordan River, but they're not the ones that's going to back up the water. The God who is over all things. That description of Lord of all, we may use terms like sovereign Lord. It's like a king who sits on his throne that controls an entire kingdom and has subjects underneath him. He's the one that's calling the shots. And it's not just in a localized kingdom. It's over all the earth. All authority belongs to God. And so when they come over into the promised land, all of these kingdoms that they are going to meet, they're in subjection to God. As part of what we'll see in Joshua 2 is anyone who submits themselves to God will actually be taken care of. And that's the story with Rahab, right? And so here we are. They have come into the brink of the Jordan in verse 12. Now, therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe of man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord, the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from following. And the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. And there it is. That's what happens. The Israelites come in. The priests go first. It's really God that's leading them. They step into the river, and it backs up, and all of the people cross over on dry ground. And where the priests are standing in the midst of the Jordan that is now dry ground, Joshua's told, all right, tell one man from each one of the tribes to come get a stone and set it up on the other side of the Jordan so that when they see this stack of stones, somebody's going to say, what does this mean? And you will be there with your children and you will tell them what we see in Joshua 4, 22 through 24. Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over. As the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which He dried up for us until He passed over, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. I love these stories in the Old Testament where you have something very visual that you can see, and it calls to mind a statement. It calls to mind a teaching. That's why when you read Deuteronomy chapter 6, where God says, you know, I want you to have the law, and I want it written on your hearts, I want it written on your minds, but also want it written on your houses. When you lie down, when you stand up, when you walk along the way, there are going to be things that you see, and you get to tell what they mean. You know, it's beautiful when we have scriptures around our homes. And our children, as they see them, want to know, all right, what does that say before they even, you know, are able to read? What does that mean? Well, let me tell you. When they're able to read it, you're able to teach them. These visuals, it's very important, and this is one of them. They see these 12 stones. Dad, why are they here? Let me tell you what God did. I love that as a teaching moment, and I think we need to find more ways to do that with our friends, with our family. Any of those little visuals, things that we may sit on our desk. Somebody walk by, hey, what does that mean? Where did it come from? Well, let me tell you, and it gives us an opportunity to teach. Maybe you want to get a stack of 12 stones and put them in your office or in your home and get somebody to ask questions. Let me tell you the story about what God did for his people. But as I look here in Joshua 3, and the stories continue on in Joshua chapter 4, once again, I want to highlight this topic of humility. For everyone involved, it takes humility to go somewhere you don't know where you're going. You don't understand exactly how you're going to get there. But you know that it's going to be God that does it. And all the plans that you may make, you have to realize he's going to be the one that's controlling them. And even when you make plans, he's going to do something different. Potentially. But we need to be reminded, whatever happens, to give glory to God. And that we exalt him instead of ourselves. I think that is the heart of humility. So as we go from here, I want to just put another question in front of you. Would you rather be humble or be humbled? Now, you know the answer to that immediately, don't you? Nobody wants to be humbled, all right? I want to start out with humility. You know, I want to be a humble person. I want to have the right kind of attitude, but I don't want anybody else doing the work. You know, it's one of those, there's a number of things in our prayers that maybe we're timid with asking God. You know, it's like, God, give me patience. Oh, really? You can learn patience. Is that what you're ready for? And it's like one thing after the other is in front of us. Like, okay, I had to learn patience in that. Do we ever pray, God, give me humility? If we did, all right, we're already recognizing, all right, I have a pride problem. But if we say, God, give me humility, are we willing to be humbled? Because that's maybe what it takes. Somebody that recognizes they need humility is probably because they struggle with pride. I'm saying they, all right, we all struggle with this, right? This is something that we can acknowledge. But if we think about asking God for humility, and are we willing to be humbled if necessary? You know, humility has a positive and a negative connotation depending on where you're reading it in the scriptures. On one hand, a humble spirit can be produced with divine action, but it also can be involved with one's own initiative. Or maybe someone else is involved in the making of one to be humble. It can be profitable, it can be enriching, it can be a condition that we want to find ourselves in. But on the other hand, it might be a consequence that one may experience by someone else. It could be because of sinful actions at the hands of someone. It might be a difficult situation in a social setting, any of these things that may cause us to be humbled. Or maybe we want to talk about humiliated, right? There's the other term to associate with it. There's a lot of passages that may come to mind when you think about humility. I want to talk about two of them quickly. In Proverbs chapter 22, verse 4, the writer says, "The reward of humility and the fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life." Now, I'm always intrigued by this verse because what sticks out to you here? The reward of humility and the fear of the Lord is, all right, I'm good, honor and life, but that riches thing, right? Are we doing the, you know, health and wealth gospel? You know, as long as you're humble, you're going to have all the money that you need. As long as you're humble and you fear the Lord, you're going to have all the honor that you can handle. You know, it's interesting when you study the book of Proverbs. It's a fun book when you look at each one of these individual statements, and some of them are associated in context of one that comes before and after. Some of them are just these standalone statements, and they are confusing. I think there's something interesting about humility that we're already spotting here. Humility is able to make us see things from a different perspective. When you think about a leader who is humble, that may not be the first characteristic that comes to mind, because a leader needs to be someone who is out front, someone who is strong-willed, someone that is able to lead the people with a strong arm, and they're not behind the scenes, because somebody who is humble, you know, they're going to be meek, they're going to be lowly, they're going to be down here serving behind the scenes. That's not what I expect of a leader. It's exactly what the way that our world thinks versus how we as Christians should consider this topic. Humility is able to exceed our expectations. And I don't think what's being taught here by Solomon is that you are going to have riches, you're going to have honor, and you're going to have life, but I will give us an individual test. Have you seen God take care of you in life when you swallowed your pride and you submitted to Him? I think we could go around this room and talk about things that have happened that exceeded our expectation when we stopped striving. Times where it didn't make sense how this happened, where this came from, and what went on from there. You know, it's not, you know, miraculously we opened up our bank account and all of a sudden there's money there, but I'm sure that we've all had situations where didn't know where you're going to get the money that you need, and all of a sudden something happens and you come across some. You know, God is able to bless us in many ways. And it may not be in riches if our bank account is going to be padded. I don't think that's what's going on here at all. But I think there is a test of relying on God instead of relying on ourselves. When we take the form of a servant, we will realize how rich we really are. When we take the form of a servant, we will find blessings left and right, because it's not about us. It's going to be about something else. In James chapter 4, verse 10, humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and He will exalt you. It's the same idea that you can find in 1 Peter chapter 5. But it's reoccurring, and it's exactly what we see here in the book of Joshua. When we humble ourselves before God, He's going to be the one that's doing the exalting. And it's not that we may pat ourselves on the back, it's that we may glorify Him. Anything that, you know, any good gift comes from the Father above. The book of James explains that as well in James chapter 1. When we're less concerned about ourselves and more concerned about God, we will see this be a truth over and over again. And like I said, I think that we could probably go around the room and talk about these situations left and right if we were honest with ourselves about it. So let's draw some application beyond this, and some things that we can learn about humility from Joshua, but also just practical day-to-day living. I want to begin by thinking about humility. Let's talk for a minute about what humility is not. Humility is not about humble bragging. Have you ever heard of somebody that has humbly bragged about themselves? It could be, I barely studied for that exam, and you know, I know I aced it, but I just barely studied for it. You know, it wasn't that big of a deal. I don't know how I managed to keep my 4.0 GPA with all these things that I have going on my plate right now. Our students are here, so I can talk about maybe potential pitfalls they may fall into when it comes to humble bragging. But it can also happen in a job interview. You know, that question you'll see on in a little bit, we'll talk about weaknesses as well. But that question, you know, what do you consider to be, you know, your greatest weakness? I'm overly eager to please my customers. Or it's hard for me to work on teams because I'm just such a perfectionist. In some ways, those are certainly humble braggings, right? I think that's what's going on here. That is not what humility is. It's not self-deprecating where we're putting ourselves down, but then we're going to add in a little something just to lift us back up. That's not what humility is all about. Humility is not about being unable to accept a compliment. If someone ever doted on you or told you something positive and you didn't really know how to react because you just thought that, you know, you were thinking too highly of yourself. Maybe you worked on a project. You did something around your house. You built something. You drew something, or, you know, I don't know. Something that you accomplished, and somebody came by and talked about how good that is, and you did such a great job, and you don't know how to react. I think ministers, we experience this. You do, you know, present a lesson, and somebody comes up to you. It's like, man, you did such a great job. It's like, okay, what should my reaction be with something like that? You know, I struggle with that of, you know, being able to take a compliment and it's like, okay, well, I'm not bragging on myself, but, you know, I don't want to be too prideful about it. But we probably have other situations in our life where that's happened. That's not what we're talking about with humility. There's going to be some more things that are going on with it. Humility is also not discrediting yourself. You don't have to turn yourself into a doormat. That's not what humility is. you can be a leader and be humble at the same time. It's a trait, as we've examined, where we put ourselves in the right position with God and not try and lift ourselves up, but also we can recognize we have things that we can do. Joshua was certainly a leader. And we're studying the book of Joshua, thinking about leadership, but when we look at the precedent set with the story of Moses, Joshua had the skills to be in front of people. Joshua had the skills to lead people. He should know that, which is what brought him over into this position. He's the one that went into the promised land originally and said, "We can defeat the giants who are there." That's the kind of person I want leading them, right? We think about this from, you know, his set of skills. If he were to say, "Oh, I'm not really that good of a leader, you know, I don't have the skills to be in front of people," maybe he could think properly, "I want to lead the people, but I'm going to have to do it with God." Doesn't have to discredit himself. Being reserved or lacking an opinion. No, we can have these things and be able to speak up. So humility is not these. There's something more that's involved. So a humble leader, let's talk about as we conclude what a humble leader really is about. Number one, a humble leader gives proper credit. Is it easy or hard to give someone credit for the work that they have done? I was just talking to somebody over the holidays, and they were in a group meeting with their boss and the boss's boss, and other people had been working on some projects, okay? And it's him and another individual sitting across the table, and they were talking about a project that they had presented to the big dog boss, okay? This is a big deal that they did this presentation, all right? And somebody, the big dog said, "Look, you did a good job on this," and one person piped up and said, he said, "Yeah, you know, I'm the one that put that together." And the one I was talking to, though, he certainly didn't put any of it together at all. He put no work into it whatsoever. So he stepped back and he said, "Oh, really? Tell us about the process you went through to put this presentation together." And the guy just sat there and just floundered because he didn't do any work at all, but he was taking credit for someone else's work. And he was dangled out there in front. And he got his legs cut out from underneath him, and he got humbled, right? Should have been humble from the beginning, but he became humbled. Do we give people proper credit? Do we tell them, "You did a good job. Keep up the good work. Thank you for doing that. I couldn't have done it without you." When we give someone else the credit that is deserved, and the respect that they deserve, it takes humility. Even if we're involved in it. I don't like group projects. In school, that's not one of the things I enjoy because, I don't know, personality flaws that I have. I know that I don't play well in teams. And so I might run over somebody and just go ahead and accomplish it and just say, "All right, well, this is what we're going to do." And I just end up doing all the work. But that is not healthy, right? That's not the way to do it. Instead of us working together, you know what? Yes, they accomplished this. They did that over here. All right. I think we can see the importance of giving somebody the proper credit. Here's another one. A humble leader admits mistakes. Is it easy or hard for you to say, "I messed up," like a PowerPoint? For you to admit that you have made a mistake. The phrase, "I am sorry." Is that something that comes out easily, or is something that we choke back and we want to hold on to? It's like, "I'm not going to say that. Even if I know that I'm wrong, you're not going to catch me making that statement at all. I'm not going to admit to it." To say, "I'm sorry, I'm wrong, that was my fault." But also owning up to stuff. Even the language that we use. You know, I've been called out on this, and I've thought about it, and looked at it from different angles as well. You know, if I do something and I mess up, even the language that we use to apologize, it says something about our heart and our demeanor. Here's what I mean. There's a difference between, "I'm sorry, I messed up, I did something wrong," and "my bad, we'll fix it later." Right? There's a difference, isn't there? By even glossing over terms, it says a lot about our heart. We can say that we're sorry, we can admit to a mistake, but if that humility is not there, then we're not really being genuine. But to say that I'm sorry, that I did wrong, whether we're talking about our marriages, we're talking about in our jobs, there's a lot of room there to be leaders with humility. A humble leader accepts criticism. I don't know if you've ever asked somebody for criticism for something that you do. Maybe it's in your job. Do you look for the boss to give you feedback or criticism? As a teacher, I don't look forward to, but also in another end, I do look forward to the end of the semester when there are student reviews. It's where, you know, for Faulkner, we have these reviews that go out for each one of the professors, for each one of the classes that we teach, and it's anonymous. You know, us as professors, we want to know who submitted it. It's like, I can kind of tell, depending on who says what, you know, things along those lines. But I'm always, you know, a little worried about when they come up because they are published after the semester's over, after the grades have been published. So, you know, there's nothing that it can work on behind the scenes. But to open that up and, you know, this, you know, did your professor do this on a scale of 1 to 5? But then there's the comments section. I'm always so scared to read the comment section because it's a comment section that's also anonymous. And that can be a really good thing or a really bad thing. And some of those are a gut check. Punch you right in the stomach. It's like, oh, yeah, I knew it was coming. But to hear somebody actually say that, okay, I know I really do need to work on it. But to ask someone openly, how can I be better? How can I teach a better Bible class? How can I teach a better sermon? How can I be a better father, a better mother, a better husband, wife, friend? I really want to know. Be honest with me. It's hard to hear criticism. It's even harder to ask for it. But I think if we are willing to lead with humility, we need to be ready to do that. And to have in our minds already some phrases that will help us. Thank you for letting me know. But what do you do with unsolicited criticism? There's examples in the book of Joshua, and there's examples with Moses as well, and we've talked about a few of them in passing. What do you do when people just come out and they give you their opinion and you're not prepared for it? How can we prepare now for knowing that somebody may have something to say? Well, if we start practicing humility, we can receive things like that. There's always things that we can do better, which is what leads me to this point. Humility, being a humble leader, helps us overcome weaknesses. It's hard to admit that we have weaknesses, first off. It's another thing for us to try and figure out how do we deal with them. When we admit our weaknesses, we have to admit that there's something that we have to actually work on. Many people like to be identified by their weaknesses. That's just the way I am. No, I'm not going to try and be a more social person. I'm not going to try and tame that down. I'm not going to try and learn something new. This is just the way I am. That's a bad attitude to have. To admit weaknesses is one thing, but to seek a way to overcome them is another. Now, we're not saying that we are going to be perfect, right? If we were perfect, we'd be God. But the standard that's in front of us is to be like Jesus. He is the perfect example. Is there any part of our life where we can just write off and we can say, God can't work here? Is there any attitude that we have where we say, nope, put an X over that, God can't help me here. That's just the way that I am. Or do we identify that, swallow our pride and say, okay, you know what? I need to be nicer. I need to not speak in this way. I need to get out of my comfort zone. I need to go over here and do that and speak to this person or, you know, step out on a limb and try something new. We got to be willing to work beyond our weaknesses. So pride rears its nasty head, and it tells us that we're okay with our imperfections, but we can actually overcome these weaknesses. And then finally, a humble leader helps others. As we come back to this part, as we conclude our lesson here, in Joshua 3 and verse 4, as they're coming over into the promised land, it's not just for Joshua alone to have an inheritance. He's not coming to the promised land and he's going to set himself up as king and he's going to reign over the whole land. That's not it at all. He is bringing the people to their inheritance. He is leading them into what God has already promised. A humble leader is able to help others reach their destination. Number one, our destination should be heaven. The reason why I want to be kind or I want to be loving or I want to put myself to the side and consider the interest of other people is because I want them to be in heaven. In my example, and the things that I say and the things that I do can stop somebody's growth. I'm thinking about some recent situations that we've come across of just some people not having Christian attitudes. And because of that, a door was shut between another group of people. They didn't want to be loving. They didn't want to be willing to work with other people and help them get to inclusion. They just said, no, I'm done with them. I don't want to have any part of it at all. You see, Jesus humbly came to this world to take on the form of a servant. Came when we were dead in our trespasses, when we were dead in our unrighteousness. He came to save us. The humility, as Philippians chapter 2 speaks about, for him to come here to lift us up if we will submit ourselves to him, is the example for our lives. When we think about helping other people, maybe we need to consider what Joshua was willing to do to lead the people. He let God lead first. He put himself in the place of a servant, and he was willing to help them get to their inheritance. So, as we examine this evening, as we finish up, think about humility as a leader. There's a lot that we can learn from Joshua. And as we continue on in the story, like I said, we'll advance a little bit more, and then we'll backtrack and connect some other chapters that we missed. But I appreciate you guys being here. We'll go ahead and dismiss for the evening before our devotional.